Hi, folks, it's Denise Howell, and welcome back to Uneven Distribution here on the Hearsay Culture Network. I'm here today with my old friend and colleague, Franklin Graves. Hey, Franklin.
Hey, Denise. Thanks so much for having me.
It is wonderful to see you again. Franklin and I got to know each other because he worked on my former show, This Week in Law, was an invaluable contributor there, and has gone on to do great, great things, as I always knew he would. Right now, he is senior tech counsel at HCA Healthcare. He's the author and of the Creator Economy Law newsletter. And that's what we're going to cover today. We're going to talk about the future of creativity, the creator economy, and what exactly the role of creativity and creators will be going forward as we gaze into our crystal ball. As you know, on this show, we, with huge kudos to William Gibson, we talk to those among us who are already living in the future. And Franklin is in the way in which he's been paying attention to the creator economy and the role that creativity will play, is already playing in all of our lives and is poised to play as we move ahead. And this isn't your first brush with understanding creativity and creatives. You were also with a music label for some time, correct, Franklin?
Yes, that was actually my first job right after law school. I went a non-traditional path, they might say, where I worked in-house at a record label. I was the only attorney, and luckily it was a classical music record label. And I was able to like really get into the weeds and the nuances of music law, works that might be public domain from a composition standpoint, or some other standpoint, and kind of fast forward from there, and how they can still be exploited today. But then also the tech component, because it was a classical music label, and people are always like, "Oh, classical music, cool." But when I first joined, I was like understanding more about what they offer, and they had streaming platforms. They had, before Spotify even, they had a video music streaming platform and a music catalog where you could go and look at the liner notes and go deep into the weeds as you would be studying classical music or all types of jazz and the like. And so that was my first gig out of law school and jumped right into the fire learning what it meant to be an attorney in that world.
Right. And you did so with a type of creative that our society tends to go straight to when we traditionally think about creative people, musicians, artists, mm-hmm. writers, comedians, performers of some type or another. But of course, when you and I started working together in the mid-2000s, that kind of definition of creative and creativity was expanding to include things like blogs and podcasts, and increasingly now some form of content that is packaged to be distributed via some sort of social media platform. What do you think about that shift that we've undergone from someone who might display art in a gallery, for example, to someone who might display art online in hoping to sell it directly without the middleman of a gallery?
It's offered a democratization of sorts when it comes to having a voice and being able to distribute and circulate your voice, whether it's your literal voice or whether it's your artistic expression in some other manner. It's opened the doors wide, as you mentioned, from a distribution standpoint. And I love that you mentioned blogs, because I think in my mind, I immediately go to blogs, BLAWG, which I think you were an early pioneer of among some others, when it came to having an online presence and blogging, whether it was specifically about law or whether it was about working in law or personal blogs, all of that. And so I would say it's been this combination of increased internet broadband and access to that with a prosumer or even consumer level devices that allow content creation to match the level that you would see and expect from higher end production or traditional studio based or corporate based productions that had the financial capital to put behind all the equipment and all the other necessities, marketing, promotion, all of that. And then not to fast forward beyond the 2000 early 2000s, but even into COVID, it was this fast-paced way to get the general population more used to seeing even something like this, where if people are watching the video version of this or even just listening to it, you can use Zoom. People are more forgiving that you have your normal background of your office or even your bedroom, and people are expected to go live. And we even saw that on mainstream news and mainstream broadcast when the pandemic hit, because people couldn't travel to a studio. It was building up home studios. It was using what you had available. Webcams were hard to get at the time. So it's been this whole combination that's been building up, a culmination of events over the last 2 decades or more, where we are at this place now where you and I are on Zoom and we're having this conversation and contributing content that people want to consume in some way.
Right. And it's interesting that you mentioned people started appearing on what we would think of as more professional and highly produced programs from their offices, like you and I are now. And they haven't stopped. I go on CNN or whatever on a near daily basis, and someone is joining the show from their home office because it's just easy and convenient, and the technology is actually good enough to permit it. So I think that's a good sort of example of how these things begin to shift the way that we interact with each other, the way we do business, the way that, a high-end, highly produced, highly financially backed production will incorporate material and put it out into the world. And then on the flip side, I think you have a really good point about how we've gotten used to consuming all kinds of media and the expectation that something be very highly financed and highly produced has gone way down. And still, the quality of what people are able to put out is compelling. You know what you're getting. And you may not be, you have a different expectation when you tune on to a creative that you follow on YouTube than you do when you tune to a broadcast news, cable news channel.
Absolutely. And one thing I will say too is I think it's important to think about also the technology in our homes and our world has changed because we all have connected TVs or a connected device in some manner. And so even back when you and I were doing podcasts, video podcasts 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it really was through the iTunes store or on YouTube, watching from a laptop. And if you wanted to watch it on your TV, maybe you plugged in an HDMI cable and there wasn't a way to easily access it. So I think access to content on platforms that are just, like you mentioned earlier, the social networks. Some people argue whether or not YouTube's a social network, but a lot of the social networks or all the content distribution platforms are available and nicely packaged in an app that is just on our connected TV. And so that's another mechanism in this overall ecosystem that's empowered this ability to not just have quality content available in one manner or through one method, but in many and in one that is now in everyone's homes and competing with traditional cable television or broadcast television.
Yeah, we've definitely gotten to that point that people used to talk about where the television is less a television and more a monitor on your wall or wherever you've placed it
Yeah.
and can display anything from anywhere. Which I guess begs the question, which I'll ask you, do you think that we're starting to see the ushering out the door of traditional broadcast and cable media? Or, perhaps some of them may die on the vine while others are nimble enough to evolve.
Let me pause there. I just heard my name. So, Daddy, I heard my name. So, just 1 second. I'll be right
Sure,
back
of
to you.
course.
It's difficult to say. I don't necessarily, from my own personal opinion, is I don't see a direct competition in terms of like pushing out traditional media, broadcast television, cable television, or movie channels, all that, just because of the creator economy. It's more so I think just a platform shift. So we're seeing streaming take off. We're seeing other competing factors with traditional television, and people want to choose when they watch what they watch. That's been the case now for like the last 10 years, maybe even 15 years. So from my perspective, I think there's just a content differentiation between the two. And with user-generated content, for lack of a better term, or what I kind of deem in my head as like a higher label of creator content, is it just in a different classification than when somebody would go and watch a linear television show or even just a streaming television show. It's just very different if you're looking for scripted television or scripted movie versus something that is maybe educational, or maybe just somebody streaming live, live streaming their video game playing or what have you. I think we're seeing a lines getting blurred though. I think there's this element called FAST, which is free ad supported streaming, ad supported television, and FAST, the acronym. And in that area, we're seeing a lot of repurposing of content. So creator economy type content is being repurposed into pack and repackage as more of like a linear television show would be, where you don't really control what's up next. It's just kind of going and showing different episodes back to back. So I think the competition really comes down to eyeballs and attention span, like what people have, how much time in a day there is to reach a particular audience, and whether or not you're going to be the choice of that audience to watch your piece of content that's ad supported or trying to sell something or is made available for a fee of some kind. So that's kind of how I view it, and just backing up really fast. So I bucket user generated content into its own category here, because you do have that element, especially with platforms like TikTok. You have this competition between what is just someone in their bedroom, friend, colleague, whatever, uploading content that you would consume just because you know them and you enjoy watching whatever they're up to. And to me, that's more of users generating content on a platform, your grandmother, for example. And then I would compare that. So I do that play on words, like users generating content. And I take that and I compare it to people that are content creators that are intentionally creating content to build an audience, to provide education, entertainment, or some other reason, financial or maybe not even financial, just because they love doing it as a hobbyist. Those are the content creators, and there's that intentionality that distinguishes the two categories. And then the third one, just really quickly, is I identify influencers as a subcategory of content creators. And so that's obviously its own distinct set that I don't have to go into right now, but that's kind of how I view it. So go back to the main question though. I think that, yes, I think the industries are the content industries between traditional television and the newish creator economy content ecosystem are competing for attention in an attention economy, if you want to call it that. But I don't, from my standpoint, I don't view them as direct competitors outside of that.
Okay, I take your point. Here's something I think something like YouTube and TikTok, but particularly longer form YouTube, is a direct competitor of and is supplanting what its traditional role was in our economy and in our media diet, and that is the magazine. I feel like YouTube is the new magazine because things that I used to go to a print magazine for have very smoothly migrated to the YouTube platform. And that, when I go and watch YouTube, that is the kind of content that I'm consuming. You know, I used to, for example, subscribe to Popular Science. And anything that I might have read in Popular Science back in the day has been replaced by something similar, someone similar who is creating on YouTube and presenting the same kind of content. Fashion for sure. And it, you know, I mean, I think there are one or two airport magazine stand kind of fashion magazines that are still clinging to life and still, you know, broadening out their offerings in the world beyond just their print publication, because that's not going to support them. But If you want to know anything about that arena, YouTube is the go-to, and there are thousands of creators devoting themselves to that on that platform. Tech. Used to subscribe to Wired, probably should still, right? Wired's a great publication. I still enjoy reading their content, but I read it all online. However, there's so much great tech journalism that happens in a video format, in a podcast format, that's now how I consume those things. So there, I think we're really seeing a replacement of something we used to have. And I do speculate how that will continue to evolve in the future. Any thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. And newsletters. I think that's another important one to think about. I think we get a lot of breaking news from newsletters. Mm-hmm. I think Platformer and Casey Newton are a great example of that, like going on the tech example there.
Yeah.
That is one way. And I think of, you mentioned magazines. I think of YouTube as a way to compile your own magazine, if you want to view it that way. You can watch content that might be all related. Maybe it's a recommendation algorithm, or maybe it's just your subscribers that you intentionally go in and watch videos from, but you can compile your own magazine. You're the editor. you're playing editor in that sense. And podcasts, I would say, are the same. And really what I think we're seeing, because I use Apple News Plus. I absolutely love that app in particular, because it, like with Wired, for example, it still gets me access to a lot of those traditional print publications. But what I'm finding too is I like the ability to switch content delivery methods. So like if I want to read an article, I can do that. But if I need to be in the car ride or have my headphones in, I can, instead of reading, I can listen to the same article. And whether that's Gen AI powered or whether it's an actual human narrator, that is one element where I'm seeing I dip my toes across different types of consumption methods, but I mix it in, to your point, I'm mixing it in more frequently with podcast and other types of non-traditional media or publications.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% there. And I'm constantly looking for ways to consume things audibly that I used to read. And I don't know if that's just my own kind of busy life where that's the time I have to squeeze those things in. But the curling up with a book or magazine thing for me is kind of a thing of the past, unless I'm deeply, deeply on vacation. Let's talk about how the creator economy is paying creators today and how you see that evolving. Right now, you've already touched on a few. You talked about newsletters where people would pay a subscription. Podcasts do that as well. Video channels can do that. I believe now all of the content that I watch on YouTube, I have a premium YouTube subscription. So I'm paying YouTube, which then in turn takes some of that and pays creators. I've seen some people try and do like a paid tier on top of their YouTube channels. That seems to me like sort of a lost cause, especially if they're targeting people who are already paying YouTube. Can you flesh this out a little for us and talk a little bit about how viable it is to make a living this way?
It's viable. It just depends. That's always a difficult question, a difficult topic to approach. Because there's arguments within the creator space that every platform should pay every creator, regardless of subscriber levels, regardless of metrics that might be necessary to unlock payments or what have you. If somebody is consuming my content that I released on YouTube or on Instagram and there are ads that run against that, the platform earns revenue, I should get a cut of that. That's just not how it works, unfortunately. Or maybe fortunately, depending on if you take the platform side, because they don't have to pay out people that have been vetted, or maybe they haven't gone through the proper process to apply for a partnership program of some kind or a payment share, revenue share of some kind. So then if you look at it from that perspective, yes, creators at some point do unlock the ability to get a share of ad revenue from a platform or just revenue not even ad, just revenue generally. If like for what you were just mentioning, YouTube started out as YouTube Red, then it became YouTube Premium. And it is the ability for you to pay to not have ads. And then you get the creator gets a cut of the monthly revenue pool that YouTube generates from that. That's one method that we're seeing. And then outside of that, it kind of then expands into a couple different ways in which creators can fund their business. So one of those is the, like we just talked about, ads. So they can utilize an ad existing ad network, and that's largely funded by the ad tech industry that partners and buys and sells ad blocks on YouTube or all of these different platforms. And that funds and goes directly into the creator economy. Or you have direct brand relationships, and that's where the influencers come in. Affiliate marketing is another way where you get a cut of the sales, or you just get a direct payment for the amount of money that you're bringing to that for access to your audience, your community. And within that, there are a lot of different layers. There's micro influencers, there's mega influencers, celebrities. So brands have come up with a target, a lot of those different tiers of how much they want to spend or not spend in a given case.
Right. And
Just one
typically
second
those
about that.
people,
Sorry.
all right.
Okay. Sorry. One last thing I'll share about that. If you want to just go and kick off with your thing, though, that's fine too.
No, finish your thought and then I have a follow-up.
Yeah, so it's the ad share, but then also there's the direct brand partnerships and relationships with creators. But then there's a third category of fan funding, so the Patreon type model, where if I particularly love and latch on to a content or want to support a creator directly, I can fund them either through direct relationship with Patreon or some other manner through merch sales or something like that that directly supports their business.
Right. So a lot of the folks that you're describing, whether you're a micro influencer or someone with a huge, you're Emma Chamberlain, okay? Huge audience, top of the YouTube pile. Your talent at that point, what we would typically think of as talent represented by a talent agent, who is lining up deals and partnerships and sponsorship and cross promotions all over the place for you, correct?
Right, exactly. So you have agents, you have middle parties, you have third parties. And then even in the creator system, there's these other tech startups that have popped up. One in particular is called Jelly Smack. They take one creator's content and they can distribute it across, like, let's just say that creators have only focused on YouTube. They've built up a huge, massive following on YouTube. Rather than manually take that video that they put on YouTube and put it on TikTok, which might be vertical video instead of horizontal. They've created a platform that will automate a lot of that, and then also draw revenue and maximize and speed all that up. So yeah, that there is a lot at play in terms of how the creators are making that money and how they're distributing their content. And it is sometimes direct with a platform relationship or through third party agents managing it, production companies, or third parties like Jelly Smack as well, content distribution networks.
Yeah, it's all really fascinating. I'm wondering if you have a good handle on, so what I would think of as the primary distribution channels for creator content, as we've defined it here, is YouTube, as we've mentioned. Certainly the Meta platforms, Facebook and Instagram. Also, of course, TikTok. And of those various things, I've heard anecdotally, I've never done the math or looked into the various partner agreements, but I've heard anecdotally that TikTok is really, really creative, friendly as far as their payment structure goes. Does that jibe with your understanding?
I've heard kind of the opposite. I've
Okay.
heard, and Hank Green is somebody in this space that is worth following and checking out and seeing what he says. But he has spoken on this, and he is definitely somebody, and others are more in tune with the direct payment kind of relationships, which platform's better. But what I've heard is, especially with Facebook and Meta, or Meta's obviously owns Facebook and Instagram, WhatsApp, but on Insta and Threads now, but even Facebook proper and TikTok, both of those have had difficulty aligning advertising with the short form content, because on YouTube, longer form content, this was pre-shorts, their launch of shorts, which are the reels and the TikTok version of TikTok for their platform, it was easier. Consumers were more accepting of ads that rolled or that were pre-roll ads or mid-roll ads if your video is long enough, or even outpost ads. But with short form content, it's always been the struggle of how do you monetize? How does a platform monetize eyeballs in those instances and actually have marketers pay as much? And so that's been my understanding of it all along. And so from what I've heard is even creators on like TikTok or Instagram typically try to do a for you, like of a for you page. And so they have a link in their bio type page, and they can go and then sell courses or sell downloadable content, or direct people to the longer form versions of their videos on a platform like YouTube. And so that's been kind of their sales funnel or marketing funnel, is to redirect people off the platform. But of course, the platforms have caught on to that, and they deprioritize algorithms that algorithmically deprioritize videos that might send people somewhere else or talk about content that's off the platform. So there's those elements that are at play. But TikTok and Meta and even YouTube, when Shorts first launched, they offered creator funds, which was just they dedicated $1 million into a creator fund and would disperse that in some metric format that they just defined at the beginning. And so that would be one way they could incentivize creators on their platform. But yeah, I think it's interesting and certainly worth discussing with individual creators that are trying to figure out which platform works best. And Reddit is a great resource for that, for people that share that information.
And it's super important given that TikTok may not be available for people to use in the US, depending on what
Yes.
happens. Would you, I'll give you my own reaction to will TikTok go away in the United States? And I don't think so. I think that they will definitely work something out. There will be agreements and guardrails and whatever will allow lawmakers to go to their constituents and say, "Hey, we identified this problem and we fixed it for you." So, yay us. What do you think?
I think we've already done that. I mean, I don't have an answer. I honestly don't know. I think that from a national security standpoint, from a fairness standpoint, because we've been talking a lot about traditional media, and traditional media companies would never have this level of ownership from what do they call it? From a foreign adversary controlled network as opposed to foreign adversary controlled application. So just from a fairness perspective, I'm balancing that with, of course, the First Amendment arguments are being made, and defenses are being made there. So from my perspective, I think that there's a lot to just consume and to kind of not just easily say, yes, a ban is the most effective method here or the most fair method here. And more so what I'm looking at it from is understanding, okay, from a high level standpoint, what does it mean to have a platform that is had proven ties to a foreign adversary or whatever, and how do you balance that with what we have here in the US, which is this freedom of expression, this freedom and ability to decide if we want to transact on a platform that has foreign adversary control of some kind. That's up to us as citizens. That's up to us as individual consumers, as to whether we want to go on that platform or not. And going back to your guardrail scenario, that's the trouble with that is I don't see how that's any different than what Oracle has supposedly been doing with Project Texas, in terms of having its own server here, with all the data being stored, no data being transferred out, despite people coming out and whistleblowers saying no data is still visible to in China to Chinese nationals, what have you. So ultimately, I feel like it's a very complex situation that I have probably no business opining on. And there are people much smarter than me that know way more on both sides than I could ever know, just from, you name it, national security or some other reason why. But I agree. I definitely, and even back the first time this came around, I disagreed with the approach of attacking the app stores that were hosting the app and making them be forced into pulling down an app as a distributor of the platform. That to me was kind of more concerning, was to have a government controlling that level of overreach into an app. Well, it's only two in the US, but Apple and Google, those app stores, which is trademarked by Apple, of course, those app stores, to be able to control that. That to me was like one of the first iterations of the bill that we saw. And I don't believe that's the current one where it's the app stores that are going to have to take action and all of that. But anyways, it's complicated. And I think that ultimately the guardrail scenario, I don't see a way in which China, and to their defense, they shouldn't, a way in which they can fully divest the app and still have all the control over it or the benefit of it being operated fully independently here in the US, and whether they would do that or not.
Yeah, that's one that'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out. But I think you and I both agree that the demise of TikTok in the US is probably not a likely scenario. Let's move on. You touched on when you're talking about the app stores, the juggernaut that is Google, and of course Apple too, but let's focus on Google for a second. Because you did an interesting piece. You've been paying attention to the fact that of course, Google owns YouTube, and Google is has recently published some guidelines for creators on YouTube that helps them navigate for people who have no legal training and no background in intellectual property law. They're just out there creating, editing their own magazine, as you said, and using other material to do that. Google has published, or YouTube has published, a series of guidelines on how you can reuse other people's content in your works, and what's n going to violate those guidelines and get your video, I don't know what the terminology is, banned, pulled, no longer viewable on the platform. So on the one hand, YouTube is wading into that water and trying to, I think probably taking a step back, why are they doing this? To head off complaints, regulation, legislation from intellectual property owners that are saying, hey, my stuff's getting used right and left by your creators on your platform. So I think what they're trying to do is thread a needle there to keep the intellectual property industrial complex happy, and also keep creators able to be able to produce things. So on the one hand, they're doing that. And on the other hand, over on the search side, and we're going to talk more about AI and other contexts in a moment, but I'm sure you've been experiencing, as I have, as we all have who use Google Search, that AI is starting to creep into our search results in the very top things that you see, unless you, do some technological tweaks and somehow make it go away. The first thing that you're seeing in Google search results these days is not links to the websites where you might find your answers. It's a nice little summary, AI generated, that presents, hopefully, the answer that you've been looking for in such a way that you will never click through and go on to that site. Funny. Should Google have its own guidelines for how it can reuse other people's content in its search results? Maybe they should talk to the YouTube folks. What do you think?
I have a lot of thoughts. I, in particular, take them in reverse order. Google, the most recent Google I/O conference, was interesting because I thought that same. I watched like a The Verge does like a Google I/O in 15 minutes or 7 minutes or whatever. I watched one of those, and one of the clips was a person on stage talking about that exact feature, and kind of spun it in a way of like, oh, and then the person can go directly to that resource and dive into more details. And it's like every time I've used the tool that you're talking about, where I'm on my phone, I use DuckDuckGo, but I switch over to Google 90% of the time just because it's better. And I've started getting those results at the top that are Gen AI powered, and it's just so immensely helpful. I don't go anywhere else. Like I don't need to, especially for the one-off answers, like how to reconnect my Ring sensor on my window. Like it's so easy to get that. But at the same time, I do think about, okay, the underlying content that's being surfaced came from somewhere and somebody published that. maybe for a monetary reason or to drive traffic to their blog or to engage with the consumer of that content in some way. And that's being taken away by a tech giant. And what does that mean? Do they even have consent to do that? Do they have the right to do that just by crawling the web and providing search results?
Right. And it mirrors somewhat the complaints and the lawsuits against Google for including news resources in its news search results and preventing people from going directly to those sites and, helping whatever financial model is in place at those sites to keep that publication afloat, hopefully. Now we're seeing that happen with the rest of the web, and I think it does sort of shift the conversation when it applies not just to media outlets but to all manner of search results. There are people out there saying it's breaking the web and this isn't how the web was supposed to work, and it does seem a little ironic given YouTube's approach to being so circumspect with intellectual property on its platform, because of course, before it started being circumspect, YouTube's survival was not necessarily guaranteed. It was very much in the intellectual property industrial complex's crosshairs and was taking hits right and left. When you start broadening that out to search, again, it shifts the conversation because we all need, as you said, there are alternatives out there to Google search, but they're not as good. And in order to
Not to knock
navigate,
DuckDuckGo, sorry.
yes, not no, and I use it too, but for the same reason that you do, I don't use it all the time. So I think this is an interesting conundrum that Google has teed up here. And I what do you think will happen? Do you think regulators will come down on them and say, no, I'm sorry, you can't just demonetize the entire web?
Right. I'm so glad you asked that question. It's a valid question because the question, especially like a year and a half ago when OpenAI launched their chatbot, I got to this place of where I started questioning like the why, like what is the why behind this? And there's an easy why behind this. Like if you're Google and if you're the consumer wanting a quick answer, like that's a simple why. But there's a deeper why that should also be asked. And I think that's kind of where like we get in, you ask the well, but then what happens? Because I think Bing is a good example. Microsoft has implemented Copilot as part of Bing Chat. Well, now it's just Microsoft Bing powered by Copilot or whatever they call it. And that one actually, in the terms, I've read those, and it indicates that they do insert ads into some of the surfaced search results. And so I think that's kind of my question is, especially with Google too, it's like, where does this leave us in the future? Like, why now? And then what happens next? And so the next thing is like, okay, well, how do they monetize this? Because if all they have is a very short window of space on a web browser, then where does that leave us? And actually, so I just taught cyber law for the first time at a law school this past spring, and I used Eric Goldman's fantastic Internet Cases book that he's published. And in there, I think it's so interesting because I showed my students some of the slides that of how Google Search and Google Ads used to be in a pre-mobile environment.
Yes.
And it was just like so easy to see and distinguish them. And then you move to a mobile device and it's the screen real estate and the space in which to present search results to users has shifted dramatically. And now it's even more so with chat. It's like literally, where are you going to insert the ads? How are you going to present those ads to non-paying users? Or are we looking at it where we're in a future, again, going to the then what? It's either how do they advertise it or how do we pay for it out of pocket? And so far, a lot of it is you pay, unless you're providing them all your data for free, and it's an exchange in that way.
Right, which is how Google works now. I mean,
I meant
as
like the
far as I
chatbot,
know,
sorry.
oh
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
for the chatbot for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, you could definitely see Google adding paid tiers, but then are they going to share that revenue with the
Right.
sources of the search results themselves? I don't know. I mean, at some level they would have to, or the entire system begins to fall apart like a house of cards.
And that
And
was one of the whys that I asked with YouTube, because like
yeah.
on YouTube, they've offered the ability to like for they've done this for a while with YouTube with search on Google. You would get surfaced a YouTube video and it'd break out exactly which segment to watch. And you could go direct that segment and watch that part of, oh, here's how you fix this part of your toilet if it's leaking or something. And with YouTube, though, I think they're even now showing a way to summarize a video. And it's sidestepping, going back to the creator economy discussion, it's sidestepping the content creators and minimizing the exchange that can happen of ideas and the ability to just like you and I are sitting here talking. Sure, people can listen to us on 2x, or for me, it's usually 1.5 speed for a podcast, but you still have that time to digest what is being said, hear the full thought process and the flow of the discussion. Whereas if you just read a summary, if it's accurate, where does that leave you from truly engaging with content and being able to digest it and formulate ideas around it and have that extra space that we typically need?
So what we may be honing in on here too is how inadequate the entire ad supported infrastructure is for the purpose that it's been employed. People hate ads. And to the extent they either hate them or they mildly tolerate them, or they're annoyed as hell that the ad has targeted them so well that they actually go out and buy the thing and they resent it. Right? I mean, there's nobody who's actually, well, okay, maybe I'm being too broad and sweeping and saying there's nobody that likes that ad that makes them buy something.
I think it's very telling that you pay for YouTube Premium, because that shows a dedication to not wanting ads. Like,
It
that's
does.
impressive.
It
Like, that's
does.
impressive.
And I don't think that I'm alone. It's a dedication
No, no,
that
no, no.
it's a dedication that actually goes, to the bottom line. But I guess where I'm looking ahead in the future, if you and I right now were going to both try and predict and script what we would like the future to look like, of course, mine would be ad free. I suspect yours might be too, which then means people have to figure out other ways to monetize. And people have to be willing to pay for things that they've gotten used to being free. And I do think that we are moving in that direction, with subscriptions and of various kinds, and as you say, Patreon and other ways of supporting. But the other thing that I think, time and time again, when people are looking at the impact of generative AI and what it can do now and what it will be able to do in the very near future, and then in the very far future, what seems to rise to the top every time, back to creator and creatives, is the layers that are going to peel off the economy economically because these tools can fill so many roles are the ones that don't involve a lot of creativity, the ones that involve a lot of sifting or rote kind of work, a lot of things that humans can do, but it's just not, what you would call creative. And where the human value comes in, that these tools, may someday be able to approximate, but they certainly can't now, is the actual creative spark that makes the magic. So I think that we may be shifting, if I'm going to make a prediction here, to an economy where, as we sit here today, and traditionally, as we've both grown up in the world, being a creative was a choice that people made because of their passion and their compulsion and their talent. But their parents often shook their heads and said, gee, we really wanted you to be a doctor or whatever, I mean, something more practical and financially stable. in the future, being creative may be the linchpin to being financially stable. Do you agree?
That's a really interesting way to view it. And I'm actually speaking of the different economic generations that we've been going through, I'm actually working on a legal academic article that dives into the history and kind of what I've been using so far, what I've been kind of explaining so far is kind of explaining and giving an introduction to what this concept of creator economy law is. And part of my research, I was looking back and trying to find the origins of the word creator economy. And people have looked at the word creator and tried to come up with, okay, where'd that originate from? And it goes back to YouTube for the most part and early days of that to kind of put a name aside from influencer or aside from internet creator or something like that that has more of like a negative connotation to it. Anyways, what I found though is the concept of the creator economy was first put out there back in like 2008, around that time period, by futurist Paul Sappho. And a part of his early writings on the topic indicated this shift, and it ties very nicely into what you just talked about. We're shifting out of the consumer economy of the start in the 50s. And then before that, it was the producer economy. So the producer economy, then into the consumer economy. What we're kind of seeing is a shift into what he deemed this creator economy, but more so in the context of creator, meaning everyone's a creator of data. We're all generating data, whether it's Internet of Things or using smart devices, ways to go to and from a location, you name it. We're constantly, my dishwasher can connect to Wi-Fi. Like, why? Going back to your question, why? I've not done that. I refuse to do that. Anyway, sorry, I digress. It's this question of, okay, we're
You
in this.
know why,
I know why. Yes, I know why,
though.
but personally, I don't know why.
No, but we should enunciate why on the show is, as you said,
Yes.
if
Yes.
all you're creating is data, data is valuable.
Yes.
What is the expression? Data is oil, the new oil.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's what Paul was building on this concept of data is the new oil. We're moving into a data-driven economy, and he was calling it this kind of this concept of everyone being a creator, whether it's data or whether it's content or whether it's whatever. And part of that was the social media movement too. Everyone could publish anything on your mobile device at any moment in the early days of Facebook, starting there and then moving into now. And so that's kind of where I saw the term originate in my research. And I think it's very telling here because it does impact. If you think about moving and shifting from a consumer economy, it begs that question that you just talked about. Well, what happens to advertising? What happens to consumerism? And if we are then, if marketing and ad agencies and the like are unable to target individuals or sell to them or reach them at all, then where does that leave us in a creator economy that largely has been driven by an advertising ecosystem, an ad tech ecosystem? And so that to me is kind of what I'm looking and trying to figure out for the future. Where is the revenue model here? And I don't necessarily go all the way to like a Sam Altman type thinking of a universal basic income type approach. I don't go that direction of like we're going to be at that point and that artificial general intelligence, AGI or whatever the singularity is coming. Like, I'm not quite there. I don't necessarily prescribe to that mode of thinking. I think it's going to get better, and I think we're at a turning point. We have been. But in reality, I think there is going to be a shift in how we consume information, content, and how it's delivered to us. But also coming with that is this whole concept of how do we do that responsibly? How do we do that ethically? How do we do that morally? That still, of course, as with the internet, it just goes out there and you got to move fast and break things and you got to figure it out as you go along.
Well, I do think back to my point that there is going to be this reevaluation of the role and value of being a quote unquote creative, or maybe we won't call maybe the terminology will shift, but what we would think of as the creative, innovative, inspirational spark, that is the thing that is your competitive value as you go out into the career marketplace. Because I mean, look, for we're both lawyers. we look at the, if you look at the legal profession, which is one of the ones that is most vulnerable and most often cited for how AI can come in and really transform how things are done. There, people come out of law school, they go work for a law firm or some government entity, and the jobs that they are given to do as junior attorneys are very AI amenable. Mm-hmm. They're synthesizing documents. They're organizing documents. You know, we used to do it with actual paper. And now, you know, it's all digital. And when it's all digital, a machine algorithm can do it far more effectively than a human can. So you could see these like lower tier activities of the profession just getting evaporated. Whereas, you know, going into a courtroom and having that degree of organization, persuasion, and storytelling that you would need to sway a finder of fact to come out in your favor, maybe AI could help with that, but I don't know, you know, are we going to get to a point where AI can do the job? We're a long way from that. We're a long way from where AI could know every aspect of a multi-party dispute and propose resolutions that would be acceptable to make the dispute go away. Again, are we going to get there? I think on the dispute resolution side, that's a little bit more likely. But
can you get the people there? Can you get the people that have to accept those decisions?
Right, exactly.
To get there too.
Yeah, no, again, you need someone who can persuade them along those lines. So that's yeah. Where, I mean, on the legal side, those are all very creative, think on your feet, vast knowledge and experience and be able to, you know, connect dots in ways that maybe an AI, well, certainly not now could do, but maybe would still be difficult in the future. So I really think that being a creative person is going to have like tangible economic value as we go forward in the future. And it really makes me think about a flip. And again, we're going to get into some more of my media diet here. There are a couple of things in the current season of Bridgerton that stood out to me, other than all the steamy sex. And one is, there is a character who has become newly noble, become part of the nobility in an unexpected way, and previously made a living running a bar. And is having a really hard time, you know, a social establishment, and is having a really hard time giving that up because it was fulfilling and rewarding and a lot of work had gone into building it up. And what he is sadly learning in the course of the show is that his peers in the nobility will have nothing to do with him if he's actually out there performing work. Right. So that's something that I see could possibly come back to us through a Sam Altman-esque version of the world, where AI is doing more and more of the tasks and there's more and more sort of leisure. And the other sort of corollary also from Bridgerton is this emphasis on it was really again, it's because these landed gentry have so much money and so much time on their hands. But I guess that is partially the aim of some of the people developing AI, is let's get to a place of security where humanity just feels great, is healthy, and has time on its hands. And so in that landed gentry reality, there was this huge emphasis, especially on all these leisure activities, especially for the women. They were quite creative activities, music, embroidery, art, you know, actual painting, literature, and these sort of very upper crust pursuits. And of course, the men were out hunting and drinking, but...
They're not going to pick up a needle and thread.
Yeah, maybe if they had, you know, in our modern, more elevated society, maybe men would do other things. But I wonder if these sort of ancient tropes that we see in something as, you know, trite as Bridgerton could actually be something that lies ahead for us. What do you think?
I definitely see a future where we do question, why wasn't AI used? And it's kind of this concept of, okay, if I go to see a doctor and they are not using an AI assisted, they're not reviewing my scan with an AI assistant. Is that malpractice? Should they be using something that has a probability rate and accuracy rate of close to 100%, and has been proven to be better at spotting issues that doctors or providers just overlooked 40% of the time? I think we're going to get to a point where we start seeing this expectation of how are you implementing AI, and I think it kind of goes into this newer concept that people are spouting of it, not spouting, but people are saying of it being more like, instead of artificial intelligence, augmented intelligence, where it's providing an assistant. That's why Microsoft calls it Copilot, what have you. But even as lawyers, I think about it, like, if I, and as an in-house counsel, as a person that hires outside counsel to do work for me sometimes, like, my expectation is going to be, if you could have saved 10 billable hours with an AI tool, or it's work that I could have performed in-house, I might have that expectation from up above. Those types of questions are going to be starting to get asked of, why were you not using an AI tool? Maybe generative AI, maybe some other flavor or a shade of AI. But that's kind of the future I see. I see us in a place where augmented intelligence is more so all around us, and we've become more comfortable with it, and particular use cases and solutions built for those use cases alone are what we're starting to see roll out. And that is a powerful way in which it could either improve our health, improve the quality of legal services, or allow indigent clients or underrepresented people to have access to justice. Or, to your point, it could free up, as a lawyer, maybe I could still charge the same amount, but it could free up time for me to go paint a picture during my workday instead. That's kind of the future I see of it unlocking more capabilities and augmenting our capabilities, whatever those might be.
Right. Well, let's hone in on that for a moment and pull back from whatever sort of Bridgerton-esque world that may await us to more the near-term future, where
you notice I dodged the bullet, and I'm going to say it now, but I know of unlocking the ability to have more free time to do things like procreate or just have fun in other ways.
I mean, we definitely, you know, I mean, people can beg to differ on this, and there are people out there who think the hustle is all that we should aspire to, and is an end that is worth all the means to get there. I have always tended to disagree with that, and I've always focused more on work-life balance and having a more sort of sane existence, less stress and you know, trauma, high blood pressure. And you mentioned before the show, and I want to bring it up now, this notion, you know, a lot of the people who are out there, and there is a lot of hustle involved, making these creator content vehicles, whatever they may be, YouTube, TikTok, out there putting them out. Sometimes they do put them out in a very high quality, but high volume way, where you know that they're putting a lot of pressure on themselves just to get the product out there and make that cash. But you gave me an acronym I hadn't heard before, FIRE, financially independent,
retire
early. Yes.
Yes.
So hustle, 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 and then sit back on your laurels and enjoy it. Do you feel like that's a big hallmark of either young people today or the creator economy in general or both?
Yeah, so it's whether it is a side hustle or a gig economy, or whether it is a full-time career that someone's able to make out of what they're creating online, it's definitely opened my eyes to understand this concept of the FIRE movement, which is basically taking the traditional concept of working 9 to 5 or some other type of traditional job and working at that and not doing anything else, focusing on maybe just your hobbies that are just hobbies and aren't for an income source, or your family or other pursuits that you might have that, again, are not for primarily income-driven sources. And it kind of takes that and it says, well, instead of working until you reach retirement age, whether that's in your 50s or late 60s to qualify for Social Security or whatever, it's kind of challenging it and making people think, okay, if I'm contributing to a retirement investment of some kind, what is the magic number that I need to be able to, if I wanted to, quit my job and then be able to be financially independent and sustain my same level of living or a lower level of living that I'm fine with for retirement purposes and retire early in that sense. And so people call it like their FIRE number, things like that. What is your age or what's your magic number from a financial standpoint to get to for all that? And so it's this whole movement, this whole concept, and it's expanded into being able to also recognize you can build a side income. You can keep doing what you want to do. And the internet, the power of everything we talked about with the creator economy, has unlocked the ability for people to explore avenues of revenue generation that were never possible before because of distribution, lack of distribution means, or lack of equipment or ability to even reach an audience. And so there's a lot of that that is being this the being driven into this FIRE movement, kind of independent side gig, side hustle, or even full-time content creation ecosystem.
God, I'm a little terrified that what you're describing is the internet as like the new apartment building, the thing you invest in to give you passive income on into your later years. Because if
Passive
that's,
income, that's the other thing I did not mention.
yes.
Right. And that's the key, is create something once, put it out there, and you can continue
Right, it'll
driving
keep
revenue
getting
from it.
monetized as it keeps getting views. Okay, well, I get that part of it. Yeah. I was a little frightened that, and there's plenty of this content out there where it's just content for the sake of putting something up that will earn money. That doesn't, it's not about somebody's passion. That's not, it's all just, and I think there are plenty of how-to videos and sites to do this. Just, how do I package things up and hang ads on it and have it spit back money? And how do I optimize that? It's the new SEO, as far as I can tell, is how do I create a video that will just get clicks, maybe. And I have the feeling, because every now and then you stumble on one of these and you go, it's one of those, and then you immediately click away.
Right.
So I don't know how they make much money. Maybe just the fact that they've been, queued up at all, is enough to trigger the ad dollars. Hence, once again, the ad dollar system is broken. But I do worry that we're increasing the level of spam and just crud content out there because people want to be financially independent and retire early, and they're just, this is their get rich quick scheme. Okay,
Well,
to go ahead.
one thing, just to really fast, just to kind of give another perspective to it too, because there are those like hustlepreneurs or entrepreneurs, whatever you want to call them, that do try to make a quick buck. But a group that I work with are called edutubers, educational YouTubers, and it is people that are teachers, people that are love content creation, love putting stuff out there. And it's a huge benefit to them because they can also monetize it and get rewarded for that. Oftentimes, the same level or even more than what they make as a teacher from a public education system or just from any education system. So that's the side of it where I've seen immense value back into traditionally undervalued professions. And I say that as my mom was a teacher, is a teacher still. And it's this element of those people are like that particular workforce is undervalued and underpaid. And that's why I love working with edutubers and giving them an opportunity to sign their first book deal and get money for that, or to publish something and to put something out on the internet and know that they're not going to get a copyright strike, things like that.
Right,
So,
right, right.
but
And
that's where I, right. Yeah.
the value of that is not just to them, but to mankind
Right.
is enormous. I mean, for anyone who's had children, you know how valuable it is for them to be able, because I'm not going to be able to help you with your math homework, honey. I'm sorry. But
Right.
if you go to YouTube and put in that equation, I'll bet you'll get an answer. And you will.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, wow, Franklin, what a great conversation this has been. To leave our audience today, why don't you give me one prediction, that flows from what we've been talking about today and one fear?
I think a predict so I'm totally I was expecting to be able to share like a recent like a recent like it like what was it, like a mess up that somebody did like you I think you did that like in the first episode but anyways I'll tie it in with my fear and so one of my fears is kind of like what we've seen with like Scarlett Johansson recently, which is like a big uh-oh from a tech company mess up slip up is OpenAI and their recent issues with Scarlett Johansson of trying months ago to license her voice to train and have an AI chatbot that has a vo voice component where you can interact with it in that way, just like the movie Her, which also starred Scarlett Johansson as the voice of the computer assistant. And so that to me is interesting too. Like that's a fear of mine. It's like where we are now. It's like they've still released something that allegedly, I've not heard it myself, but allegedly sounds just like Scarlett Johansson enough that they took it down. And they went with a different voice actress is kind of what some of the reports are saying. But the story's still developing, but the concept and the fear itself is something that I think is worth discussion. And policymakers are definitely thinking about it and talking about it. So as everyday individual consumers or everyday individual creators online, what does it mean to have access to tools where you can create something synthetic, and what does that mean for us as a society to trust what we're consuming online? That's my fear.
Your state is on the forefront of this, right?
Go Tennessee, right? Yes,
Yeah,
yeah, we have the
tell us
Elvis
about
Act.
that law.
Yeah, the Elvis Act is kind of the fun acronym for it, and I'm blanking on the actual full title of it, but the acronym for it is Elvis. And Tennessee, just like many other states, have historically had name, image, likeness rights or right of publicity statutes that gave people the right to protect, from a commercial perspective, the commercialization of their name, their image, or the likeness. Think of Elvis, which we have here in town, Graceland, and over Memphis. And so what they've done is they've updated it, they added voice, and they also address synthetic artificial creation of soundalikes of recreating someone's voice. And so it gives the ability to control that and have the ability to pursue and stop others from doing that. People like that are longtime listeners of you probably have heard you talk about it. You probably talked about it with guests on other shows before, Bette Midler and the case with her and I think it was Ford Motor Company for when they ran the ad. They originally wanted her to sing the song that they had for the ad, but she wouldn't do it, and so they went with somebody else who sounded just like her. And they told the person to sound just like her when they were recording it, and they used that, and she went through the court system, and ultimately that's where we landed on voice being protectable for at least, I think that case was in California, if I'm not mistaken.
We're often on the forefront of right of publicity law.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's one element where I think it's just interesting to think through, okay, we have laws that are like in Tennessee, they're being passed to address this. Where does it leave us in the future? A lot of that is just mostly on the commercialization side of it and leaves out what we've seen already in the news of like whether it's a athletic coach targeting a principal with a fake audio of them being anti-Semitic, or if it's like between peers in a school environment of creating deep fake revenge porn or what have you. That's a fear. But the opportunity I think that it lo unlocks from creativity when you have like the content authenticity initiative or responsible AI movements, that's where I hope that there is a brighter future where we start to see authenticity and originality, despite arguments that nothing is original with AI. There are ways to incorporate it into your work streams, being creative and still produce original content. That's where I see it from the future of unlocking creativity to people that might have never had it before, or elevating creativity that people have historically just had trouble with or taken long to produce. And then, like you said earlier, it benefits society to have that content out there. It benefits the world for that content to be produced and released.
Okay, I asked you for a prediction as well. Let me tee up a specific one for you and get your thoughts.
Okay.
And that is YouTube and others have implemented rules, are in the process of implementing rules where if you have used AI to manipulate an image, video, voice to make it appear that someone is saying something and they did not ever say it, that you're supposed to disclose that. Obviously, there will be those who don't. So YouTube will be tasked, as it was once tasked long ago, with detecting whether intellectual property was improperly being incorporated. It will be tasked with detecting deep fakes. Do you think it will be able to do that, it and others?
I don't. I think that that is going to be a whack-a-mole game, and there will always be models or other tools that are available. And when I say models, I mean AI models of some kind, machine learning models or large language models, what have you, multimodal models. There will always be those available open source on the black market, or just anyone can create them now. The technology's out there. The ability to create content that is borderline. The ability to create content that is indistinguishable, like synthetic content from human creation, is going to be impossible. And for the most part, it really already is for the most part. And so I do see a world. I think the future is where we are now left to question everything. We are left to make that own determination on our end, or we rely on third parties, like whether it's YouTube that flags content as being synthetic, and that's because user uploading it flagged it as being partially synthetic content of some kind. Or if it is federal or some type of other level of policy or legal requirement, regulatory oversight that requires any type of massively distributed content to have some type of label or have some type of indicator of some kind, so that we as consumers have that protection. I just think the reality is we are in a world now where we have to question everything, and we don't have the luxury of understanding what is human creation and what has been synthetic, or where the line is blurred along the spectrum of understanding what is partially or not, and maybe it doesn't matter. And so that's just from a regulatory or kind of just like a consumer side. But I also predict in the future we're going to have this kind of standard where we will have a segment of the population that wants nothing to do with synthetic media or synthetic content of some kind. And so, how are they served, and how are their needs met from a content consumption standpoint? And can they be? And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have people that just maybe want only synthetic content. They want to engage and have an individual relationship in some type of metaverse or some type of virtual environment with a bot, with a synthetic character, or with a synthetic individual of some kind. That might be what they want. And so where do you leave the people in between that maybe don't care, that maybe want to be at least know if they're consuming something that's partially synthetic, or entirely synthetic? So that's kind of what I see as the future, is we're going to have to, as a society, start understanding where do we personally stand? Where do we stand in terms of the content we're consuming, and how forgiving or not forgiving we are to the people producing the content and releasing it, and then also the platforms themselves that are hosting it and distributing it.
Wow. Mind blown. All right. Thank you so much, Franklin, for joining us today here on Uneven Distribution at the Hearsay Culture Network. You can subscribe to Franklin's Creator Economy Law newsletter at creatoreconomylaw.com or on LinkedIn. And anything else you want to leave our listeners with before we sign off today?
I love hearing from people. I love connecting with people. So if anyone wants to reach out, Always welcome to chat. And I just really appreciate you having me back on and a chance to connect and have a conversation like this, like we did back in the day. At this
Back in
point, we
the
can say
day.
now.
Yes, let's do it again and not wait another, God, I think it's probably been 10 years.
Oh my gosh.
So let's not do that. It's lovely to see you again, Franklin. I also love hearing from those of you out there who have taken the time to listen in to the show. And we hope you'll subscribe and support the network because, of course, we're out there trying to make these creative works work for us as well. I am Denise at hearsayculture.com. Please give me your thoughts and feedback on the show. And please continue to join us here at Uneven Distribution. Until the next episode, take care.